And first question, John, what inspired you to spend 3 years investigating the subject of shame?
You know, I think it was, well, I like everybody else, I just sort of, you know, woke up in the morning, went onto social media and shamed somebody. and like we all do and did. And then one day I think I thought, you know what, I know I've destroyed some people, but I've got like no recollection of who they are or what they did.
And you say,
to incur my wrath.
Yeah, and you say you destroyed people. Can you give me an example? And do you know, is that just your perception that you destroyed them, or is there evidence?
Well, that's the thing. I had no idea. It's like, you know, were they fine? Were they in ruins? I had no idea. And it hadn't even crossed my mind to think about it.
Yeah.
Because, of course, as I say in the book, you know, the drone strike operator doesn't need to think about the smashed up village.
That's right. And then you have that great line after about the one snowflake that causes an avalanche, or one snowflake and then it's hard to distinguish among the snowflakes and the avalanche. But one of the things I was thinking of, and maybe this isn't directly related, but the whole idea of being spam botted, that whole fake John Ronson Twitter account.
Yeah, that was one of the people I shamed. There was a fake John Ronson Twitter account with my face, my name, but a profoundly different personality. So it was this other John Ronson, and really this just completely came out of the blue. I just happened to accidentally Google myself one day and discover, and it was tweeting things like, yum, can't wait to have a delicious plate of sour cream kebab with chives, hashtag foodie. So,
yeah.
So I was like, who are you?
Because you don't consider yourself a foodie, right?
No, I actually actively dislike foodies. and I realised that this, well, I wouldn't say I dislike foodies, that's too strong, but I don't enjoy going to restaurants. And I certainly don't enjoy going to dinner parties. In fact, my wife gets really exasperated with me. The last time she took me to a dinner party, I turned up and the host said to me, would you like some crisps? And I said, no, thank you. I'm going to have cereal when I get home. And, which, in retrospect, is that the worst thing to say to somebody who's just cooked dinner for you? Anyway, my wife sort of mouthed at me, be more general.
Oh. Yeah, yeah.
So, and then I noticed that this other John Ronson was being followed by people that I knew from real life and also fans of my books.
Mm-hmm. So you were worried about them, people who were familiar with your work getting this false impression of you.
And I suddenly, I thought to myself, gosh, it's taken me like 47 years to work out what my identity is. and it's been like taken away from me.
Yeah. So,
which happens, of course, a lot to people on the internet. Maybe we'll get onto that later.
Right. I'm sure we probably will. So anyway, you met with these people who were responsible for this. Can you tell me what happened?
They were three academics. They'd met at Warwick University in the Midlands, and now they were kind of intellectuals. One was a lecturer, one was a researcher. These three intellectuals, and they had set up this John Ronson spam bot as some sort of intellectual exercise to warn me and the world of the tyranny of algorithms. As to this day, at Wall Street algorithms, how Wall Street algorithms can crush financial systems. To this day, I don't quite understand how making a fake John Ronson who's interested in kebabs will do anything to rid the world of the scourge of Wall Street algorithms. But there you go. so they refused to take it down, and they said that actually they were annoyed with me because what right did I have to be the authentic John Ronson?
Oh,
And that the internet is not the real world.
Well, which, as we know, and as is discussed in your book, is not quite the case at all. But that's where a lot of these issues come from. And they actually said they said it wasn't a spam bot, right? They said it was an infomorph.
Yeah, an infomorph that was repurposing social media data into an infomorphic aesthetic.
Mm.
So when they told me this, I felt a tightness in my chest.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, like, there's nothing on Wikipedia about my love of lemongrass and wasabi dumplings. So I still don't quite understand how their infomorph worked.
Right, or why they picked you. As you said earlier, it's not clear because you don't have a strong connection with Wall Street algorithms. You've never, to my knowledge, anyway, written about them, have you?
No. They should have picked on Michael Lewis. In fact, I'm going to suggest that to them.
Yeah, let's go. I'll go on Twitter right after this interview and look for Michael Lewis and see and find the fake Michael Lewis. But so you said they didn't, they refused to take it down, but obviously you did get them to take it down, right?
Yes. I posted the video of my interview with them on YouTube with their permission, with their blessing, and started to read the comments. And they went from like 0 to 100 miles an hour in seconds.
Wow.
So the first comment was something like, you know, I am disgusted by this inappropriate behavior by academics laughing at their victims' hurt and anger. And of course, I was thrilled. And then it went to, you know, I'm going to find them and break them and destroy them and punch them in the face, and they're just psychopaths. And then it was like death threats. It was like, let's gas them. And I was like, whoa.
Wow.
So all they did was create a spam bot with about 20 followers. So not that bad.
Yeah, so that kind of got you thinking about, would it be fair to say then that got you thinking about shame?
Yeah, that, and I realized that I was doing this all the time. It's like a kind of default position. And of course, the other really weird thing was this realization that what I was doing to other people is exactly the thing that I was most terrified would happen to me. And that got me thinking, actually, about how maybe every single one of us has bubbling away within us something that we're terrified would destroy our reputation if it got out. And it could be something like properly bad and transgressive, or maybe it's just the feeling that we're not as good people as all the other people around us. And this is like something that follows us around and it frightens us, and nobody talks about it, and we're doing it to other people.
Yeah.
We're finding that thing and exposing them.
Yeah. You say we're at the start of a great renaissance of public shaming. How so?
Well, it died away in like the 1830s, 1840s. It was stopped in both America and Great Britain because I spent time up at the Massachusetts Archives and found voluminous documents of the great thinkers of the 18th century saying, you know, we have to stop this. Ignominy is a worse punishment than death. Why do we not realise this? These people who are being whipped at the whipping post are forever branded with the taint of scandal and shame, and it's so hard to get over this, and the people in the crowd are, you know, just go crazy. And then I found all these digests that proved it, that these reviews of whippings where the critic would be scathing if the whipper hadn't whipped hard enough, and the public would be outraged if they hadn't had a good whipping. So this is why they were stopped. They were stopped because they were dehumanising and brutal, and the punishment far outweighed the crime.
Yeah.
So now they're back.
Right. And a lot of the shaming, and that much of it, it's fair to say, is taking place in cyberspace, on the internet, right?
Yeah, you know, some people have criticized my book, have said, you know, this isn't such a great revelation, you know, shame is just about, you know, people shaming other people is just a part of life. But really, things have changed as a result of social media. I think partly as a result of the technology of social media, how Twitter is set up, that you surround yourself with people who feel the same way that you do. You surround yourself with like-minded people. And on a good day, that's a truly wonderful, revolutionary thing about Twitter, that if you're having a really bad time in your actual life, you can go on to Twitter and, you know, you're immediately surrounded with funny, eloquent, like-minded people, strangers. But when we're tearing somebody apart, we're all doing it, and there's nobody in our circle telling us to stop.
Yeah, there's this whole pack mentality of people. It's kind of like a pack of hyenas. Everyone piles on.
Yeah, absolutely. And that began to interest me so much. I suppose because, you know, I've spent 30 years journeying into these kind of strange corners of power and absurdity and you know, abuse of power and people going crazy inside powerful elites. I mean, that's what kind of all my books are about, the psychopath test and them and the menstruic goats. And suddenly I thought, oh, my God, it's us now. We are the powerful, crazy, absurd people. And I've got a journey into this world and meet, you know, these victims, these people who are hiding away, having been you know, ruined at our hands, and also those of us who were doing the ruining, you know, what's going on. So I just wanted to go on a journey to try and, you know, make sense of that.
Yeah, yeah. And one of these people who is hiding away is Jonah Lehrer, who became very shameworthy after it was discovered that he'd invented some Bob Dylan quotes for a book of his called Imagine, How Creativity Works. And there was also the fact that he'd self-plagiarized several blog posts that he'd written for The New Yorker. How difficult was it for you to get Lehrer to talk to you?
Oh, very difficult. Everybody in this book, it was really difficult to get them to talk. Nobody talked to me willingly because I was asking them to let me in to the worst moments of their lives. And, you know, until you've been at the end, and let's forget for a second the kind of nature of the transgression, because Jonah Lehrer's transgressions were more serious than the other people in the book. But if we forget that for a second, you know, when you're at the end of a shaming campaign, it is so profoundly brutal and traumatizing, and it just mangles your mental health. And I was writing to those people in that moment, and so it was really hard. So with Jonah, you know, we emailed a lot, and then I flew to Los Angeles and I went hiking with him, and you know, he was just, I mean, close up, he was just so lost. And then finally, oh, and then what happened? So I had this hike with him where, honestly, I was like a cold caller, just begging him to be in my book. And he kept on saying, I don't belong in your book. And I was saying, yes, you do. You do belong in my book. He's going, I don't. And then finally I said, what do you mean by that? What do you mean that you don't belong in my book? And he said, well, what is it? What's that line, that William Dean Howells line? He said, Americans love a tragedy with a happy ending.
Mm.
And he was saying his tragedy had no happy ending.
Yeah, yeah. So what did he tell you during that hike and the other times you talked to him? What surprising things did he tell you, or what did he tell you about why he did it? And
well, I mean, obviously it was a mixture of insecurity and ambition. He felt like a fad. He felt like he was going to burn brightly and then fizzle out, which indeed is what happened, but at his own making, not at the market's making. He took on way too much work. He wasn't turning anything down because he felt like a fad and because he was ambitious. And it just became easy, you know. And then he would forget that the fake Bob Dylan quotes were in his book proposal, and then they were in his book. And I said, you forget. And he said, well, forget gets me off the hook too easily. He said, I didn't want to remember. It read well, so why check? And then the worst thing, well, I mean, if this wasn't bad enough, the man who discovered Jonah's deceptions, Michael Moynihan, who's a Dylanologist and a journalist and a blogger. And he's the first, because he was reading Jonah's new book and reading these Bob Dylan quotes. Like at one point, Bob Dylan says that creativity is a hard thing to describe. It's just the sense that you've got something to say. And as Michael read that, he thought, that doesn't sound like Bob Dylan. You know, in the mid-60s, Bob Dylan was just a nightmare to be interviewed. You know, he was never that helpful.
No, he's kind of like the opposite of you. Whereas you're a dream.
Yeah,
theater,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But that one, thank you.
thank you.
Oh, no. Creativity is just a hard thing to discover. That's my Bob Dylan impression.
Yeah, that's good.
Thank you. And in fact, if that quote sounded like anybody, it sounded like Jonah Lehrer. So Michael contacted Jonah Lehrer, and Jonah made the terrible, the very human, but very ridiculous mistake of effectively saying to Michael, my quotes are accurate, it's history that's wrong. But Michael knew that was a lie.
And he did the legwork to prove that it was. And there's this, Jonah Lehrer made this public apology at a Knight Foundation lunch in Miami. Can you tell me about that?
When we finished our hike and Jonah was just like, I don't want to be in your book. And at the end of our hike, he just completely took me by surprise by saying, I'm going to make a public apology next week. And he said, could I read his speech? So I read his speech back on the plane. And it was an apology speech like no other. It was Jonah Lehrer was trying to explain his flaws, his personality flaws, within the context of neuroscience. So it was like a Joan Alera speech about why Joan Alera screwed up.
Mm.
And so, go on, sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, sorry to interrupt. So I take it didn't go over well?
Well, no, it didn't. And the worst thing was that the Knight Foundation, who was, you know, allowed him to give this apology speech and, in fact, paid him to give this apology speech.
$20,000, is that right?
$20,000.
Yeah.
They had erected a giant screen live Twitter feed behind Jonah's head. So anybody watching Jonah's apology could tweet their opinion of it in real time, and it would appear right in Jonah's eye line while he tried to apologize. So Jonah was on stage, the most important speech of his life, trying to apologize, and in giant letters on this live screen Twitter feed was coming up, Joan Alera boring us into trying to forgive him. And Joan Alera is tainted as a writer forever. And Joan Alera is just a frigging sociopath and rantings of a deluded narcissist. This is while Jonah was in real time begging for his, for mercy. Imagine that happening in an actual court. Imagine the murderer standing up and trying to apologise and the jury yelling out, bored.
Yeah. And did he sign
off? That was us.
Yeah, exactly. And did he sign off on that? Like, I'm surprised that he would agree to that. Or maybe it was a condition of, you know, being paid the 20 grand to do it.
He didn't know until he turned up.
Oh, okay.
He didn't know that they'd done it. You know, I don't think the Knight Foundation was being, like, breathtakingly callous in setting up that Twitter feed. I think they were being naive. In fact, this was, was it 2012 or 2013? I can't remember. But even so, this was a moment when I think the idealism of Twitter clashed with the distorted reality of Twitter. Because I think the Knight Foundation set up this Twitter screen in a kind of moment of sort of idealism. We all thought, you know, Twitter is this incredible, wonderful thing. But the reality was by the time they had set up that screen, we had become, you know, devastatingly cruel.
Yeah. Well, one of the tweets that appeared on this giant screen while Lehrer was speaking read, he hasn't not proven that he is capable of feeling shame. So you've talked with him. What do you think? Does Lehrer feel shame for what he did?
Oh, I mean, he was doubled up with shame. He would talk about it a lot, how brutal the shaming process is and how he is just filled with shame and remorse. And, you know, the first thing he thinks every morning when he wakes up is what he's done wrong. Absolutely filled with shame. And so interesting that somebody wrote, he is incapable of feeling shame. And I think that was for two reasons, the person wrote that. I became obsessed, actually, with that particular tweet. So I'm glad you brought it up. I think, firstly, because Joan Alera was so full of shame that he couldn't show it. It's like it agonized him so much, he just couldn't show it. He couldn't do that thing that some people just can't do. You know, he was kind of preppy and he had dignity and he didn't want to show his weakness. And so he was, you know, he was trying to still be like the young academic. So we couldn't show how ashamed he felt, which, you know, I think is heartbreaking. The other thing is that we need to dehumanize the people that we're destroying because we're good people. We want to destroy people, but we don't want to feel bad about it. So how do you dehumanize somebody? You give them dehumanizing language. You call them a sociopath. I should say that none of this is in any way to exonerate Joan Alera's crimes. And in fact, I read something the other day online where somebody said I was being too soft on Jonah. But I don't think I am, because I don't think at any point in my book do I exonerate him of his crimes. But I think it's perfectly fine to humanise him and to talk about the agony and then to talk about the kind of brutality of what happened when he tried to apologise without forgiving his crimes.
Yeah, I think you did that. I think you did that very successfully, and it's a fair portrayal. Have you heard from him since the book came out? Do you know if he's read it?
No, I don't know. He emailed me shortly before the book came out and told me that things were actually finally, after like 3 years in the wilderness, going right for him. You know, he was happy with his family and he's working again and he's got a blog online. And in fact, at some point later on this year, he's going to bring out another book. Whether that wins him redemption or not, you know, waits to be seen.
Exactly. The speech he made, the Knight Foundation speech, do recordings of that exist? Is it available on YouTube, do you know?
Yes, it is. It's quite hard to find.
Okay.
You know, I think if you put in Joan O'Leary, I think it's hard to find because it's like about 2 or 3 hours long and Joan O'Leary's speech is like somewhere in the middle of it. But I think if you put in Joan O'Leary Knight Foundation, you can find the speech.
Okay,
yes.
Cool. Good to know. You also, oh, hang on, I just lost my train of thought here. I was making notes. Okay, I wanted to also ask you about Justine Sacco. She's someone else you write about. What did she do?
It happened shortly after the Joan O'Leary thing, actually, and it just goes to show the kind of sliding scale of what we consider shameworthy. Because, you know, with Joni really had misused his privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And that's obviously the worst, you know, that's obviously appropriately like the worst crime, the most shameworthy crime is a misuse of privilege. But then, like, we just fell in love with getting people who had misused their privilege. And so we started, you know, taking a lot of scalps, a lot of collateral damage, one of which was Justine Sacco, who is this New York City PR woman with 170 Twitter followers. Nobody ever replied. She'd write little acerbic tweets, and nobody ever replied to them. And one of these tweets, just before getting on a plane to Cape Town, was going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white. So she pressed send and got no replies and felt that sad feeling we all feel when the internet doesn't congratulate us for being funny.
Yeah, when we don't get that instant gratification, yeah.
Yeah, whatever it is, that dopamine rush.
Yeah.
Turned off her phone and slept on the plane and woke up 11 hours later and stretched, turned on her phone. And there was a text from somebody that she hadn't spoken to since high school that said, I am so sorry to see what's happening to you right now. And Justine looked at it, baffled. And then another text from my best friend, you need to call me now. You are the worldwide number one trending topic on Twitter.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Imagine those words coming to you in a text when you've been asleep on a plane.
Yeah.
So her tweet while she slept had gone around the world. It had been sent, one of her 170 Twitter followers had sent it to a journalist called Sam Biddle at Gawker, who retweeted it to his 15,000 followers, later told me that it was, that the feeling of doing that was delicious.
Mm.
I should point out at this stage that she was not intending to be racist. If she was, it would have been an unbelievably offensive thing to say. What she was trying to do was mock white privilege by doing a kind of exaggerated thing. There's a tradition of this, right?
She was just really making a bad joke. Unlike Joan O'Leary, who clearly did something wrong, she didn't. All she was really guilty of was making a bad joke.
Yeah, just not being very good at that style of humour. Randy Newman does it well in songs like Short People.
Yeah.
Short People Have Got No Reason to Live. I mean, it was just in the tradition of that. She just wasn't good at it. You know, what destroyed her was not being as good at it as Randy Newman.
Yes, exactly. And then she lost her job, didn't she? She paid like a real heavy price for that.
Yeah, but a lot worse than losing her job. She lost her sense of self. I mean, when I met her a couple of weeks later, she was waking up in the middle of the night, forgetting who she was, you know, crying out her body weight, as she described it. The newspapers following her to the gym. Her family was furious with her. You know, trolls were saying, you know, let's rape her. Somebody HIV positive should rape her, and then we'll find out if her skin colour protects her from AIDS.
Oh, dear.
By the way, nobody went after that person.
Yeah.
Because everyone was so excited about going after Justine Sacco. We can only destroy one person a night. Which is maybe part of the reason why we love to destroy people so much, because it's like the insatiable beast is sated for one night.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then there'll be someone new to pile on to the next day.
So the HIV positive person, somebody HIV positive should rape this bitch, and then we'll see if her skin colour protects from AIDS. Nothing happened to him. He was fine.
Hmm.
So and then she upset not only the misogynistic trolls, but also the concerned liberals like us. People were tweeting, you know, in the light of this disgusting racist tweet, I am donating to aid to Africa. So she really united a lot of disparate groups while she slept on the plane. And it just mangled her mental health. I mean, like Jonah, it's profoundly agonizing to be told by, you know, by your community, get out.
Yeah.
It's worse, actually. I would hazard, as awful as it is, to be attacked by trolls who use outrageous language, like death threats and rape threats, to be told by your entire community that you are worthless and you need to get out is worse because there's no support group there. There's nobody there to help you through.
Yeah. You mentioned she lost her sense of self. Has she recovered it at all? How's she doing now?
Yeah, it took a year. I asked Sam Biddle, like, how do you think she is now? And he said, oh, I'm sure she's fine. And that made me smile because I really don't think Sam Biddle was being in any way unusually glib when he said that. I think we're all like that. We all want to destroy people but assume that they're fine because mm-hmm. we don't want to feel bad. It took her a year to be okay. After a year, she got a new job. And then my book came out and then finally people were saying to her, I'm so sorry what we did to you. Actually, that's a lie. Nobody said that to her. What people said to her was, I am so sorry what those people did to you.
The other people. Yeah. What do you think it is about social media that lends itself to these online shaming sprees?
I think a lot of it's to do with the fact that, you know, we want to be good people and we want to be seen to be good people. We want to show how empathetic we are. And you know what? I mean, wanting to be empathetic is a good thing. I mean, I spend my life trying to be empathetic, which is why I write these books. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to empathize with other human beings. But the problem with these shaming campaigns, like with Justine Sacco, was that in our desire to show the other people on Twitter how empathetic we are, we committed this, you know, profoundly unempathetic act. So we wanted to show everybody that we cared about people dying of AIDS in Africa. But in doing that, we mangled up an innocent person.
Yeah, yeah. And the important point that you've made a few times already is that the us factor, the collective first person plural, because as you say, Justine Sacco felt like the first person that you'd ever interviewed who had been destroyed by us. And it makes me think of that famous quote from Walt Kelly's comic strip Pogo, we have met the enemy and he is us.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. And you know what? I've noticed, you know, I've been on a book tour for a few weeks now and you know, many times over the past 15, 20 years, I've done book tours where I've talked about, you know, the bizarre behavior of powerful elites over there. So the pharmaceutical industry, you know, when they abuse their power, or, you know, the military and the ministeric goats, or the FBI and them, how they killed the Weaver family, mm-hmm. and so on. And my audiences would always really kind of approve of that. They would agree with me that that was terrible. As soon as I say, you know what, the powerful, crazy people are now us, I've had questions during the Q&A when people have said, so Justine Sacco's a racist, so that means you're a racist too? So it's like the first time I'm pointing the fingers at us. Immediately, people ask me if I'm a racist.
Just because you're writing about someone that they misunderstand as being racist? Is that why?
No, I think it's because people do not want to be told, you know, we do not want to be told that we are now the crazy ones.
Mm.
So what do? You deflect it back by demonizing the person who's saying it. I should say, I mean, I don't want to go over the top about this. I mean, you know, most people are being very nice about my book, but once in a while I've had this, and because I've never had it before in all of, you know, in all of my years, I need to sort of try and think about, you know, why it's happening. And it seems to me that, you know, in the same way that somebody wrote Jonah Lehrer is a frigging sociopath as he tried to apologize because they needed to dehumanize him to feel better about destroying him. It's like, you know, I've noticed that happening a little bit, just a tiny, tiny bit, like a flurry with me when I'm saying, you know what, we have lost our moral compass. People just aren't willing to say, you know, I think you might be right.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, hopefully that's going to change.
Well, actually, I don't want to like oversell that because I'm talking about, you know, sort of 5% of, well, less, about 2% of the questions.
Yeah,
98% are kind of nice as ever.
Right. Well, that's good. Yeah. You actually asked the question, has Twitter become a kangaroo court? And you asked this question on Twitter, appropriately enough. What kind of responses did you get?
Somebody wrote, not a kangaroo court, just commentary, only unlike you, John, we aren't being paid for it.
Wow. That's totally wrong to me, though. I mean, Twitter can cause real damage, can cause people like Justine Sacco to lose their jobs and things. Online shaming has tremendous power, doesn't it?
Just like that guy, you know, from the Spambot video who said the internet is not the real world. This book of mine really proves that the internet is the real world.
Is that part of it, though? Is the fact, do you think that that's why so much of this online shaming happens? Are there too many people who don't see the internet as the real world? Do they lose sight of what you've described as the people being dimensional? And when they're online and kind of treat them as avatars and not real people?
Yeah, I think so. In fact, Monica Lewinsky used the word dimensional in her TED talk last week, which is really, really similar to my book. She said people forget that I am dimensional and that there was a time when I was not broken.
Mm-hmm.
And we do. We are defining and we see it every day. I mean, just in the last week, we've seen it 3 or 4 times. People getting swallowed up by their worst tweet, defined almost as if some tweet that they wrote in 2010 was a clue to their inner wickedness, mm-hmm. and that we are identifying that as kind of great detectives. Mm-hmm. So that happened to Trevor Noah. You know, I mean, I thought those 5 Trevor Noah jokes, you know, were, you know, really bad.
Yeah.
But then I remember the 9,000 tweets that weren't bad, that were good.
Yeah, and Trevor Noah, just to make sure I've got this right, he's the new host of The Daily Show, right? The gentleman,
that's
young
right.
fellow from South Africa, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we you know, in real life, we are really nice to each other when we're in the same room. I've as part of the research for my book, I met people who had to walk up and down the sidewalk wearing placards that said, I killed 2 people while driving drunk. You know, don't drive drunk or you'll end up like me. And I talked to people who were sentenced to those kinds of punishments. And I said, you know, what was it like? And this guy said to me, you know, I was terrified, but like everybody was so lovely to me. They stopped their cars and they said, things are going to be okay. And, oh, you know, you poor thing. And come with me to church. People would say these lovely things. And it made me realise, you know, in real life, we're lovely. And of course, that was what brought him back into the world, this guy. And now he runs a halfway house called Sober Living Houston. And he lectures in schools about the dangers of drunk driving, all because people stopped their cars and said to him, things will be okay. With Justine Sacco, nobody said to her, things will be okay.
And that fellow you were talking about, that's Mike Hubacek, right?
Mike Hubacek,
One of the people you talk to is a psychiatrist named James Gilligan, and he's spent a lot of time studying prison violence. And he has this really interesting theory about the connection between violence and shame. Can you tell me briefly about that?
He spent his life from the 1970s to the present day inside maximum security prisons, interviewing and trying to treat murderers. And eventually he came to realise that everybody he spoke to, every murderer he spoke to, was harbouring a secret, a central secret. And that secret was that they felt ashamed, deeply, chronically ashamed. And he was talking about kind of childhood shame, that they were beaten, scolded, abused, insulted, made to feel worthless, you know, by their parents and by their neighbours. And the people who commit terrible violent acts in adulthood are the people who are treated, you know, most terribly in childhood. And what Gilligan came to realise was that all violence is an attempt to replace shame with self-esteem. And that's, you know, I think about Gilligan saying that when I think about Mike Hubacek with his placard, I kill 2 people while driving drunk, and people saying, you know, you poor thing, everything will be okay. You know, what is the cure for shame and being cast out and being ridiculed and humiliated. It's empathy and kindness and compassion, all the things that we're really forgetting about on social media. And if we're serious about making the world a better place, if we're really serious about trying to lessen violence, then, you know, the teachings of James Gilligan is what we should be reading. You know, Gilligan set up an educational program in Massachusetts prisons to, you know, because what could be more de-shaming than getting an education? And the state governor closed it down because he said, we can't have a free education program in prisons because people are going to commit crimes just so they can go to prison for a free education.
So yeah. you think Gilligan's right? I get the sense. Do you think it's too simplistic what he's saying, or is that?
You know, it fits in with my worldview. It's really similar, actually, to my book, The Psychopath Test, which is my last full length book. Mm-hmm. In the psych, because that's also trying to understand people who commit, heinous acts. In the psychopath test, the psychologists and psychiatrists I spoke to were believers that these people were somehow like a different type of species, that they were kind of born that way and that they just had this neurological absence of empathy. And I am sure that there are people like that in the world. I'm sure there are. But when Gilligan talks about people trying to replace shame with self-esteem, that feels very plausible to me as as an explanation of violence.
Yeah, yeah, it does to me too. The more I think about it, what's the most surprising thing that you learned during your investigation of shame?
I suppose that. Let me think about that. And we're not live, are we?
No, we are not.
Think
we're
about
not.
That. Yep. That's good.
Yeah, so you got lots of thinking time, and I'll just cut it out when I edit.
Good, because nobody's going to want to hear this. Okay, let me think.
And if there isn't anything, that's fine.
I want to try. Let me get the book here with me. I want to sort of just. I talked about the cognitive dissonance, which I really liked, and about Gilligan. I've really liked this interview because I'm talking about a lot of things that. You know, towards the end of the book, somebody said to me, I suddenly feel with social media like I'm tiptoeing around an unpredictable, angry, unbalanced parent who might strike out at any moment. He said, it's horrible. And this guy was a journalist who said that he had so many jokes and little observations and potentially risque thoughts that he just wouldn't dare to post online anymore. And that made me realise that with these shaming campaigns, this kind of surveillance society that we have set up for each other, where we're just spying on each other and trying to kind of uncover clues about, you know, our fellow humans' flaws and defects and so on. Even though we see ourselves as nonconformist, this is really creating a more scared and conformist and conservative age. It's like in all of this, we think we're doing the right thing, but what we're really doing is defining the boundaries of normality.
Apart. Yeah. And that was going to be my last question. I was going to have you read that last bit on page 282.
Oh, wow. Is it too late?
No, it's not, because I can move stuff around through the magic of editing. And plus, I've got two more questions after this, but then, you know, I can move stuff around, or maybe I won't use those two other questions. So pick it up at, we see ourselves as nonconformist.
Okay. So why don't I read that whole paragraph?
Okay, yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah.
Soon after Justine Sacco's shaming, I was talking with a friend, a journalist, who told me that he had so many jokes, little observations, potentially risque thoughts, that he wouldn't dare to post online anymore. I suddenly feel with social media like I'm tiptoeing around an unpredictable, angry, unbalanced parent who might strike out at any moment, he said. It's horrible. He didn't want me to name him, he said, in case it sparked something off. We see ourselves as nonconformist, but I think all of this is creating a more conformist, conservative age. Look, we're saying, we're normal. This is the average. We are defining the boundaries of normality by tearing apart the people outside of it.
Mm. Yeah, that's a very Orwellian thought, isn't it?
It really is, right?
Yeah. Thank you, John. Thank you for reading that. I just basically had one more question. Getting back to this idea of pretending that people aren't dimensional, and that's why a lot of online shaming happens, because we don't see the full dimensionality of people. And it seems like until we get beyond that, we're in a lot of trouble in terms of making progress with this. And your book is a first great step in bringing this subject of public shaming to our attention. But I'm curious, do you have any ideas about what we need to do to take it to the next level and really clamp down on this and reduce it?
Well, I do feel like I'm part of a little kind of mini movement, but it's a movement that's having some impact. So the same week that my book's come out, Monica Lewinsky has done a TED Talk that has sort of very similar conclusions to my book. And then there's been a bunch of, editorials about my book and about Monica's TED Talk. And I think the whole thing is basically just reminding people that, we're a mixture of talents and wisdom and stupidity and crassness. And, we're clever and we're stupid and we're funny and we're not funny. And I think the thing I like most about my book, I think, is the fact that it's not a kind of academic book. It's a kind of anxiety-inducing book.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of gripping, and it's gripping because you really feel the agony of what it is to be Justine Sacco or Joan Allera. Your heart races as you read this book. I'm sorry, go on.
Yeah, no, go ahead. I was just going to say, it's very gripping. I mean, yeah.
Thank you. And it feels kind of like a visit to the slaughterhouse. It's hard to go to a restaurant after you've been to the slaughterhouse and order the steak.
Yeah.
So I'm rather hoping that people will just start to notice in a couple of months' time, as a result of my book and as a result of Monica's TED Talk, that they're just being a bit more compassionate and understanding of the dimensionality of our fellow human beings.
Yeah. That's what we need to have happen. And you had that great talk, Vanity Fair video, where you had a nice conversation with Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that, we've become kind of kindred spirits. I would never have imagined that over the past kind of few decades. But as soon as I saw her TED Talk, I just thought, my God, this is like, she has been on an identical intellectual journey to me. And her perspective is the perspective of somebody who has been, hugely shamed and humiliated. And my perspective is a journalist who's spent 30 years of his life with demonized people. And we've both come from those worlds with a really similar perspective. And so I'd like to actually do more stuff with Monica. I thought she was great.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. And thank you so much for the conversation, John. And thank you for writing such an anxiety-invoking and such a powerful and timely book.
Thank you. I really, it was great talking to you again.
Great talking to you again.